Even our rather modest ambitions yesterday, we still didn't even get to subpart number two. It's at that point where I'll take up today. Before I do, however, I'd like to say a word about a possible revision of the outline in view of... you're not expecting me to make any personal confessions about my own limitations, and I won't, because I don't want to embarrass either you or myself. The other reason is that I don't need to, because the evidence is all against me for everyone to see. The revision, therefore, is this. I think rather than count on doing three parts, as I had suggested to you yesterday I would, part one, Luther's development, part two, Luther's breakthrough, part three, Luther's reformation, at least doing them in the kind of detail with which we've been moving so far, we might still adhere to those three main parts, but shoot our wad on part number one, Luther's development. I come to this change of plans for, well, for two reasons, I suppose, or at least I have two justifications for it. One is that if we can get to the point in today's lecture where we can spend considerable time on subpart number five up there, I think then we will have anticipated at least all of the theological guts that we would be treating in Luther's breakthrough and Luther's Reformation. The other justification for spending so much time on part one, especially part one, subpart five, is that a lot of the historical material, that is the more or less non-theological historical material, which needs to be treated under Luther's breakthrough and under Luther's Reformation, you will be encountering in your own reading of Lewis Spitz, Reformation, material or spiritual. So we'll come down pretty heavily today, the Lord willing, on subpart number five. It's not the kind of coming down hard I meant. It'll be more like a thud. All right. To business. University, monastery, and priesthood, we've been exploring possible explanations as to this apparently sudden decision which the young Martin undertook when on July 17th, 1501, or 1505, he entered the monastery in Erfurt. And perhaps we've exhausted a number of enough of these alternative explanations, and let's move on now to say a word about what was involved in his entering this monastery. The particular monastery he entered was the so-called Observant, O-B-S-E-R-V-A-N-T, the Observant Monastery of the Augustinian Hermits in Erfurt. He had quite a choice, really. There were six monasteries available to him in Erfurt, and he chose what, by all odds and by all the evidence that's available, was by far the most strict of the monasteries as to its own discipline. In fact, right within the Augustinian order, as in a good many Roman Catholic orders today yet, there are two strands of monastic discipline. And so it was also with the Augustinian order at Luther's time. There was the so-called observant discipline, which was the more strict of the two, and also within the same Augustinian order, the so-called conventual, C-O-N-V-E-N-T-U-A-L, the conventual discipline, which was considerably more relaxed and not quite so ambitious spiritually. We'll have occasion to compare these two in just a moment under our discussion of Luther's trip to Rome. You won't think it flippant, I suppose. It's in order to make clear to you this contrast between the two available disciplines right within the same order. If I appeal by way of a kind of analogy from your own experience, let's say the contrast between the sort of theological education which our communion offers through Concordia Seminary St. Louis with the somewhat less protracted theological education which it offers through the Concordia Seminary at Springfield. Now, I intend no judgment, of course, either way, but so that you might see that the training and the discipline were operating at two different strata, but still very much within the same order. This made for certain conveniences, but as we'll see in a moment, it also made for certain frictions, as it so often does in other respects. All right, that was the monastery which Luther entered. During the first year, as is still the case, of course, in all the monasteries, he was a novice, and at any time during the course of that year, he was perfectly free, of course, to reverse his decision and to withdraw. However, he stuck it out. The record seemed to indicate that he was an especially diligent and especially successful novice. And so, in 1506, after his novitiate was completed, he made his profession. And he was accepted into the Augustinian order. Now it appears that rather early in his monastic career, his administrators had singled him out, and certainly not the only one, but had singled him out along with other promising young monks for the priesthood. Not only for the monastic life, but for ordination, and also along with this for advanced theological study. Now, whether or not they had in mind for him to become a theological professor or not isn't altogether clear, but it's highly likely. And so it was in the following year, April the 4th, 1507, made his profession in 1506, and on April the 4th, 1507, he was ordained into the priesthood by the suffragan bishop Laspe in the Cathedral of Erfurt. And roughly a month later, May the 2nd, 1507, he celebrated his first Mass. Also in Erfurt, not in the cathedral, but at the monastery chapel. Now, much is made in the records, and for good reason, about the fact that when Luther was ordained, and especially when he celebrated his first Mass, that he came to this experience with tremendous fear and trepidation. The whole prospect, as he said, of changing the bread into the very body of the exalted Lord upon the altar was almost more than human flesh could endure. And perhaps you remember from the film, the movie, Martin Luther, the marvelous way in which this very awesomeness is depicted by the Irish actor who plays the role of Martin Luther. That's one side of the story, however, not to be minimized. But there's also evidence, which is sometimes overlooked, that by Luther's own profession, by his own words, and he even spoke these words to his father, that he also experienced the inner bliss, as it is called, of having been entrusted with such a sublime office as the Holy Priesthood. Well, what is very clear is that he came to the whole experience and into this whole profession with a tremendous and a typical conscientiousness which seemed to mark all of his biography. The pictures, for example, that we have from him even years after this, when he was already a professor at Wittenberg. The bony, haggard face still attests to the monastic discipline, which he was observing in one form or another even then. Frequently, we know that he said confession more than once a week. It was part of the discipline of his observant order that these Augustinian monks always had to walk with eyes downcast. They were never allowed to look up. And he said that he never had any difficulty with this, especially in the presence of the opposite sex. In fact, for a long time, he asked to be dispensed by his superior from having to hear confessions from women, because he didn't think he was quite up to that. So very, very conscientious, very earnest, very scrupulous, to use the language of the monastic manual. Well, what kind of theological study did he undertake in connection with his ordination? We know pretty well at least what some of the works were which he had to read and had to master, and as far as we know, perhaps memorized from cover to cover, word for word. Didn't have to, but did. By the way, he didn't do all of this prior to his ordination. Funny thing, they don't do it this way anymore. Certainly he had to pass certain tests and examinations prior to the ordination, but there was also a provision for a theological curriculum immediately following the ordination, which was still part of the entire ordination preparation. Well, what were some of the works that we know that Luther had to work through in connection with his ordination into the priesthood? One of them for sure was Gabriel Biel's, we've referred to him several times already, B-I-E-L, Gabriel Biel's study of the canon of the Mass. Canon of the Mass is, you know, the whole sequence of prayers immediately prior to the completion of the Eucharistic sacrifice in the Mass. In the standard work, at least in that part of Christendom, standard theological study on this was the work by Gabriel Biel on the canon of the Mass. The textbook of all medieval theology, as you know perhaps, and which Luther not only had to thrash through backward and forward, but which he also taught later on, were the so-called Sententiae, the sentences of Peter Lombard. Peter had been Bishop of Paris. And not only the sentences, this would be like reading Pieper, I suppose. But along with Peter Lombard's sentences, down through the intervening centuries, theological curricula, theological education had acquired unto Peter Lombard's sentences a whole battery of commentaries upon Peter Lombard's sentences. And the ones which Luther very likely worked through were again a commentary by Gabriel Biel, the so-called Collectorium, collection of commentary upon Lombard sentences, and another commentary by William of Ockham, the Questiones, questions. See how heavily weighted at least this much of his theological preparation was on the side of nominalist, Occamistic theology. Another standard work which was essential to his reading for ordination
was one of the so-called glossa ordinaria, the glosses for the study of Scripture. This is his basic exegetical text. Now, this was pre-nominalist, pre-Occamist, and it's very likely that the particular glossa ordinaria on which Luther was nurtured was one by Walafried Strabo, S-T-R-A-B-O. Just an editorial comment in passing. Because it's pretty clear that Luther's theological reading, at least at this stage of his career, was so heavily weighted in the direction of nominalism, of Occamism, some Roman Catholic critics of Luther have often made the point, and still do today, that he never really had a chance to bed. He never really had a chance to know scholastic theology at its best. What he got instead was sort of the wild oats of medieval theology in the form of nominalism. He had never had a chance to encounter sympathetically and at first hand the high scholasticism of Thomas Aquinas, for example. Did he ever read the Summa Theologiae? If he had, would he have been nearly so negative in his reactions against scholastic theology? Well, it's hard to say how well, if at all, Luther knew the Thomist theology at this point in his career. Later in his career, though, the evidence is pretty strong that he knew what he was talking about when he would quote Thomas Aquinas. And this even doesn't begin to deal with the whole issue. There is the question, the farther question, for example, whether Occamism really is so offbeat, whether it is the out-in-left-field variety of scholastic theology that some Thomists like to make it out to be. It's interesting, for example, that if it really is, that the Roman Church has never condemned it. But beyond that, I'd commend to you a very recent book which has just come out within the last few months, which deals precisely with the underlying issue that's at stake here. And that's a book by a Luther scholar from Harvard. His name is Heiko, H-E-I-K-O, Obermann, O-B-E-R-M-A-N-N. Heiko Obermann, and the title of the work is The Harvest of Medieval Theology. And Obermann's whole thesis, which he argues very brilliantly, is that nominalism, far from being the dregs, the fag end of high scholasticism, is indeed the harvest. The real logical crop that emerges from high scholastic theology. And he traces the direct lines of development from Thomism into the theology, for example, of Occam and Trippetter and Biel and Usingen. I suppose I don't have to tell you that Obermann is not Roman Catholic, but he is held in high regard by Roman Catholic scholars in Europe and in this country, and also for the work which he's just now done. In fact, I was just at a colloquium with him for 3 days about a month ago, in which he was working with Roman Catholic theologians who publicly expressed their high regard for this book of his. Unfortunately for us, I suppose, not really, he isn't Lutheran. And that's been the story of our lives in America here. The best Luther studies done by English-speaking authors have not usually been done by Lutherans.
high time we catch up. And of course, we're beginning to. We've got our own lights, like Yaroslav Pelikan, Louis Spitz. Obermann joins the ranks of the non-Lutheran Protestants who have really begun to turn up the stones once more in basic Lutheran research. Obermann is Dutch Reformed. By the way, just in case any of you happen to be free this coming Friday, I believe it's 11 o'clock, Obermann is going to be lecturing at Eden Seminary. And I think his topic is New Trends in Lutheran Research, something like that. We invited him to come here, but he just wasn't able to make it. He'll be back. All right. After Luther's completion of his theological studies, evidently through the master's degree, or the equivalent of that, at Erfurt, he was shipped off for a brief stint, barely a year, to do some teaching at a nearby university, University of Wittenberg. Now, you mustn't confuse this teaching stint that he did at Wittenberg with his permanent stay there. He went there only shortly and came back again. He was only 25 years old at the time. And I gather he was sort of troubleshooting when he went over. He went over to fill a temporary gap in the teaching staff at Wittenberg. It's interesting what he taught. He taught a course on moral philosophy, on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. That's from 1508 to 1509. His order, the Augustinian order, was under obligation. It had pledged itself to supply the professorships in theology at Wittenberg. And he was the one who was got the touch for the job. All right. Part three, duties in the order and the trip to Rome. I'm going to make short shrift of this. It's an interesting chapter in Luther's career, but since time is short, it isn't worthy of our extended attention here. Suffice it to say, first of all, that as was generally the case in the orders, that even the monk who was engaged in rather ambitious theological study, or perhaps especially that monk, often was saddled with all sorts of additional administrative duties besides. And so you might keep this in mind, by the way, if you ever encounter theological professors today who groan about the many editorial and committee assignments and all the student counseling they've got to do and whatnot, and who hanker for the days, let's say in the 16th century, when a scholar could just be a scholar, you tell them that that age evidently never really existed. Luther himself is a case in point. Even when he was in the midst of his theological studies as a monk, he had all sorts of administrative work to do in the order itself. Even some years later, when he was permanently stationed at Wittenberg, and he was embarking upon the most difficult stage of his teaching career, when he was undertaking his first massive lectures on the Holy Scriptures, we know that then he had three very responsible positions in connection with the order. For one thing, he was the sub-prior of the monastery. He was the director in charge of studies in the monastery. And he was the district vicar, having under his supervision 11 different monasteries at the time. Oh, I mention this now in connection with his trip to Rome. There was a bit of a rhubarb that had sprung up between these two factions I mentioned to you before within the Augustinian order in Germany, the conventuals and the observants. And we won't go into detail as to just what the issue was. In a way, it boiled down to this. Were the conventual
Augustinian monasteries going to be put under the thumb of a provincial who, by the way, happened to be Johann von Staupitz, whether they were going to be forced to be under a provincial who was himself an observant. It's interesting that Luther was sent to Rome to deal with the vicar general of the order to get a ruling, and he went representing, even though he himself was observant, he went representing the cause of the conventuals against Staupitz. Well, to make a long story short, the Staupitz side of the issue, really Staupitz himself personally, wasn't in favor of the plan that wanted to elevate him over the conventual. In fact, by the time Luther got to Rome, Staupitz withdrew his own name. But at any rate, the ruling from Rome was in favor of the conventuals. And from what we know about the issue, it was only fair that that's the way it should be done. In other words, it was in favor of Springfield, let's say. And Luther came back, and as I say, Staupitz was altogether reconciled to this. And it seems that the friendship between Luther and Staupitz became warmer and closer from this time forward. But evidently there was still bad blood left as a result of this issue. And that seems to be, I'd underscore that word, that seems to be one reason why when Luther came back to Erfurt from Rome, that he was not kept on at Erfurt. It was thought wise that he move over to Wittenberg permanently. But it's just as sure that that was not the main reason why he was sent to Wittenberg. The main reason is this, that Staupitz himself, who had been the University of Wittenberg's professor of scripture, now asked his young colleague, didn't ask him, he ordered him, I guess. He asked him, but Luther said he was willing, but if he'd wanted to, he could have pulled rank on him and made him go. Staupitz, who had a deep love for this young theologian, this young monk, invited Luther to go over and take his place in the chair of scripture at the University of Wittenberg. But as we wrap up part three on his trip to Rome, may I just say this by way of drawing a moral from this. Here, too, the storytellers like to overrate the importance of this journey to Rome for Luther's later Reformation work. Suggestions are made, for example, that when he got to Rome and saw how corrupt and how perverse was the brand of Catholicism, of Christianity, which was being lived in the city of Rome, that this is the thing which at least helped decisively to turn him against the Roman hierarchy. And there's no real evidence for this. About the only evidence we have is that later on, after he did stage the Reformation on altogether different grounds, not moral ones at all, he, on occasion, would cite as additional ammunition the corruption which he had seen in Rome.
This is not a decisive factor, I don't think, in the Reformation. All right, now on to part four. Doctor and professor of scripture. So we said that he went to the University of Wittenberg to succeed his superior, Johannes von Staupitz, very eminent theologian. He was a Saxon nobleman, his background, highly learned, and evidently a very warm sort of person. Luther's at least unofficial father confessor, who evidently did a great deal to mold the theological and the spiritual image of this young monk. In order for Luther to take on this new job, it was a requirement that he would have to get the doctorate, which he did with amazing speed.
He fared very well in his doctoral examination, which in those days took the form of a public disputatio,
a disputation. And
his Elector Frederick the Wise of Electoral Saxony, picked up the tab for his studies for the doctorate. They were concerned about fellowships and things like that in those. And his
Elector Frederick the Wise
of Electoral Saxony, picked up the tab for his studies
for the doctorate.
They were concerned about fellowships and things like that in those days, too. Just a word in passing about the University of Wittenberg. It was only about a decade old at this time when Luther got there. It was in about the most unlikely town that you could wish for a university to be. A very dirty, not very scenic town.
And evidently about the only
advantage which spoke in favor of erecting a university there was the
feature of economy.
It just
so happened that for a long, long time before this, there had been
a collegiate ecclesiastical
foundation there,
which was bringing in a tremendous revenue. It was a rather well-heeled foundation. And one of the great sideshows of this foundation was Elector Frederick's own collection of relics,
the viewing of which brought
much indulgence to those who made pilgrimage to these relics. So here was this monetary source, which made it a natural, fiscally that is, to build a build a university in connection with it. There was this revenue and the professorships that were established. Took some finagling. The professors were hired on as canons. It was a kind of legal fiction, as canons of the foundation. But they had virtually no pastoral responsibilities in connection with the foundation. In the surrounding parishes, for example, they would be provided with vicars, and that's what they were called. And the vicars did all the work, but the canons drew all the income, virtually. And the vicars got room and board, I guess, and money for smoke, but that's about it. At least that was the situation at first in the early history of the University of Wittenberg. Another feature that you might bear in mind about this young, struggling university, which was just a kind of nothing to begin with, it was a nothing, for example, in comparison with the University of Erfurt, an old, dignified university of long standing. And that was that because the University of Wittenberg had to establish its place in the sun, it evidently didn't find it worth the risk to adopt a single theological position for which it would stand, as, for example, Erfurt did. Erfurt was clearly a center of nominalistic theology.
At the University of Wittenberg, you had a variety of theological shades and hues. Staupitz himself very likely was not nominalist, probably a Thomist with a heavy shading of German mysticism from what we know about him. We do know that another one of Luther's colleagues there, Karlstadt, was an out-and-out Thomist. But this made life interesting. Of course, in the sequel, the years to come, after the Reformation, the University of Wittenberg had all it could do to keep the students away. It became famous overnight, and largely because of the reputation of one and two men on its faculty. All right. Now, what did Luther do there?
By way of his lectures? The first great series of lectures were his lectures on the Psalter, 1513 to 1515,
the so-called Dictata Super Psalterium, the dictations on the Psalter. These were discovered, by the way, the manuscripts for these were discovered 1874.
And then after the lecture on the Psalms, his famous lecture on the Epistle of St. Paul to the Romans,
1515-1516.
And this manuscript was discovered
in 1899. See how recent this was.
He lectured on Galatians in 1516. And this, by the way, was not the series of lectures on Galatians which you read last week.
Actually, he lectured on Galatians three times in his professorial career. And the series which you read was his most mature series of lectures on that epistle given in 1531. But as a young budding professor of scripture, he lectured on Galatians in 1516. And then his lectures on Hebrews in 1517. The typical approach, was the approach which Luther himself had been exposed to as a student and which he adopted as a teacher, was to distribute to the student an interlinear text of the scriptures with lots of room in the margins and lots of room between the lines. And then the instructors, who simply lectured, would dictate to his students material for them to put into the margins or between the lines. One of the common ingredients which he would dictate to them would be the so-called glossa, as we spoke about them before, the glosses. And these usually took the form of definitions. And you'll still find in Luther way at the end of his life, when he's lecturing on Genesis, for example, or, for example, in your reading last week on Galatians, every now and then you'll find him saying, you recall, to his students, a good and proper definition of Jesus Christ is, or a good and proper definition of a Christian is so-and-so, or a definition of sin is so-and-so. And you can just hear them scratching as they scribble this between their interlinear versions of Galatians. And another, a second ingredient in these exegetical lectures were the so-called scholia, S-C-H-O-L-I-A. Occasionally, when the exegete would come to a particularly fruitful verse, he would launch out on a long extended lecture on just that verse. And the students would take this all down almost verbatim. Well, let's stop and say in one sentence what Luther's stature seems to have been by this stage of the game. It's pretty clear that he was, by this time, that is by 1515, 1516, he was the bright young lad. He was the pride and joy of the Augustinian order in Germany.
commanded a tremendous loyalty among the members of his order. He was the hometown boy who had made good and showed a lot of promise. Nobody, though, so far as we can tell, ever thought of thinking of him as a reformer of the church, and perhaps he least of all. And in addition, let's say too that for all of the prestige that he seemed to enjoy within the Augustinian order, he was by no means a celebrity nationally, and certainly not internationally at this time. Well, we have the manuscripts of these early lectures on the scriptures, Psalms, Romans, Galatians, Hebrews. As I mentioned, the manuscripts of some of them were discovered only very recently, close to the end of the previous century. When they were discovered, and this was probably the great impetus which launched what has since been called the New Luther Renaissance, the whole new look in Luther research got a tremendous shot in the arm from the discovery of these manuscripts, these early biblical lectures. And one of the points which was made resoundingly by the examination of these lectures was that it suddenly became clear what the real, shall I call it, the secret of the Reformation, in fact, was. The real secret of the Reformation was not Luther's battle against, let's say, the practice of selling indulgences. And it was not even his fight against the centralized power of Rome. But that the real secret of the Reformation, positively speaking, was basically a theological discovery about what makes the Christian gospel the Christian gospel. And that point, by the way, and generalize it for a moment, bring it up to date. That is a good point which Lutherans do well to remember in the current dialogue between, not between Protestants and Roman Catholics, but between Lutherans and Roman Catholics. As I find again and again in the course of this dialogue, the real rock of offense which divides us, that is, Lutherans and Roman Catholic Christians, isn't just the issue, as it might be, for example, between Roman Catholics and, let's say, the Reformed Christians. It isn't primarily the issue of authority. It isn't, for example, primarily the issue between scriptural authority versus the authority of the magisterium or the papacy. But the real rock of offense which divides us, and which in most places still hasn't even begun to be touched upon in the dialogue, is the basic soteriological question, which, to use the shorthand term, is the doctrine of justification. All right, part five. Struggles in the monastery and the tower experience. We haven't said it, and I suppose I should have reminded you, like a Greek chorus, like an old refrain, time and again, in the points I've made previously, that all the way through this period, at least from the time that Luther entered the monastery on upward, there are evidences of the tremendous unfechtungen, the tentationes, we called them yesterday, with which and in which he was constantly hovering back and forth between life and death. That is, life and death in the only ultimate sense of those words. On the word tentatio or anfechtung, I suppose we can assume that they have become such common coin, even in their foreign version, Latin or German, that it's hardly necessary to give them an English translation.
And the more important point, I guess, that is, even if it were necessary, there isn't one. To translate unfaithfulness literally as assault loses something, shall we say, in the translation. But it was the experience, finally, of being assaulted, shall we say, not only by one's own sin, but on account of one's sin, being assaulted by the devil, more than that, by the law, and more than that, by the very law of God himself, by his curse. In the experience of which Lizzie said over and over again, a man feels that he has been divested, he has been stripped naked of every shred of righteousness to his name, so that he has not one thing on the strength of which he can stand boldly and confidently, coram Deo, before God. And if he has nothing of value by which he can count for anything at all before God, he has nothing on which to hang for dear life. And so everything goes dead in you, all turns to ashes, and a man is black. Now, this is the sort of thing that negatively Luther is speaking about in his unsession. He could put it much more graphically and vividly than I did. Let's ask to begin with, on the negative side, what can we say for sure? Are the negative explanations of these so-called struggles, these assaults, these unfechtenen, these tentaciones, what are, as far as the historical evidence can prove, are the explanations of the negative side of Luther's inner breakdown? Well, one thing a historian certainly cannot overlook in trying to account for these mortifying experiences, and by the way, if you get occasion to see John Osborne's play, Luther, and see Albert Finney dramatize a tentatio in the St. James Theater off Broadway, that's an experience. It gets just a little schmaltzy, I'd say, but evidently it was every bit as physical as Finney portrays it to be. Well, one facet, though, which the historian cannot overlook, as a contributing factor, certainly not the sole explanation, but a contributing factor to the tentationes, is the whole monastic way of life to which Luther had subjected himself. Monasticism, particularly in the lofty form in which Luther encountered it among the observance of the Augustinian eremites, offered a promise of a way to perfection. Now, when we say perfection, though, we ought to hasten to add that this did not mean, at least it did not mean literally, that here the candidate was offered a way to moral perfection so that finally he would be absolutely sinless. It was a basic plank in the platform of monasticism, indeed, that he should recognize to the day he dies that he has fallen short of perfection. Now, Luther hardly needed to be told that. But it did offer a way to perfection, if by perfection what we mean is that there was at least a minimal offer, a minimal prospect of assurance, of peace of conscience, of the consolation of having been saved. Primarily through the special way, special discipline to which the monk subjected himself and which the ordinary layman did not subject himself to, represented briefly by the threefold vow of chastity, obedience and poverty, the keeping of the evangelical counsels, the high emphasis on searching out, rummaging around in his innards for every last vestige of false motives, of pride, of superbia, of libido, of lust and concupiscence and all the rest, and sweating them out, exposing them to his sight, and praying for the grace in the sacraments to expunge them from his life. And then on the side of consolation, in this monastic way, there was always offered for the monk, who, having encountered this profound guilt within himself, would hear the word of consolation in the sacraments, in confession, absolution, and penance. Now, how is this a negative contributing factor to Luther's Tentatione? Well, this promise of at least modest perfection, meaning by that modest assurance of the grace of God, turned out to have virtually the opposite effect for Luther. To put it briefly, the harder he tried, the harder he failed. And it wasn't that he couldn't live up to the evangelical counsels as well as the other monks could. He could say of himself as an Augustinian, like Saul could say of himself as a Pharisee, that he was a superlative monk. But that only aggravated the difficulty. And it wasn't only that the harder he tried, the more he found that there were things which he had left undone. That's often the picture we get. Let me just finish that sentence. It wasn't just that he always found there were still additional things which he had not yet done. But it was more profound than that. The harder he tried, the more he found that his eagerness to twist God's arm by his attainment, that very eagerness to win God's favor was the very root and core of his difficulty. This is the subtlest pride of all. Perhaps the pride which says, God, I can never please you. And the awful temptation to be pleased with that, the fact that you can be so confoundedly displeased with yourself. Perhaps that at least God will like. He will love your flagellation of yourself. So it was endemic, not an accident, but endemic to the very monastic piety itself to foster rather than to overcome and correct this high pride, this subtle superior, which drove a man away from God rather than to him. Okay, we'll pick up here tomorrow. None.